Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This hour we talk about the nation's first Jewish sports star, Hank Greenberg. And here is a tribute to him, a song tribute, performed by Bing Crosby and Groucho Marx.
Oh, goodbye, Mr. Ball, goodbye. You had better kiss your relatives goodbye. When Hank comes to the plate, Ball, you're going to be out late. So goodbye, Mr. Ball, goodbye.
Our guest this hour is John Rosengren. He's the author of seven books, including several on baseball. He's written for Sports Illustrated and many other publications, taught literature and writing at the high school and college level. And he has written a very interesting biography of Hank Greenberg, interesting because of his being the first Jewish superstar, but also the time in which he lived. It was not an easy time, and that's an understatement, to be Jewish in America or to be Jewish in the world. The 1930s were his time. The plight of German Jews was the central theme in temples and synagogues throughout Detroit, where he played. And we're going to be talking about Hank Greenberg and the times in which he lived, anti-Semitism that he faced on and off the field, and also the Jewish fans, what they saw in Hank Greenberg as an ability to shatter stereotypes and, as our guest writes, to secure for Jews their rightful place in America's promised land in the years before the nation of Israel galvanized ethnic identity. John, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Our great pleasure, and happy almost baseball time. It's a perfect time.
Thanks, eagerly awaiting opening day.
I'm sure you are. You know, let's start with the times in which Hank Greenberg lived, because they're very important in terms of who he became to people in this country, the hope he gave to people, and also what he had to face as a ball player. As you write early in the book, these were not easy times for Jews in America.
Right. I think in order to understand Hank Greenberg, it's important to put him in the context of his times. He was a great ball player. He became enshrined in the Hall of Fame, and he'd be a great ball player today. But it was different the times when he was playing. In the 30s, there were several factors at play that count for his significance. First was it was a time of intense ethnic identification. Many immigrants grew up in homes, or the second wave of immigrants grew up in homes where their native tongue was spoken at home. You know, they spoke Polish or German or Italian, and they really identified much more strongly with the nationality where they came from, as well as with their American identity. So you had the Italian Americans, the Irish Americans, et cetera. Greenberg grew up speaking Yiddish in an Orthodox Jewish household. His parents had immigrated from Romania. So there was that strong ethnic identification. Then there was the fact that there was, as you alluded to, the intense anti-Semitism. And not just in Europe, where many Jews had escaped from the persecution, come to the United States, but also in the United States, where anti-Semitism was as widely practiced and socially accepted as Jim Crow laws. Greenberg had a scholarship to Princeton, but wasn't allowed to attend there because Princeton had a quota of only 2% of the student body being Jews. Mm. One of his teammates lived in a restricted community, meaning no Jews allowed. You know, there were no Jews allowed to practice medicine at certain hospitals or to practice law at certain law firms. And so the anti-Semitism was very strong, and Greenberg certainly faced that with ethnic slurs and taunts and insults from opponents and even teammates. And then the fact that he was a baseball player in the 30s, when baseball truly was America's game, and that put him on the national stage. So here came this guy who's 6'4", 220 pounds, big guy, in an age when the average ball player was about 5'11", so he towered over them, had this massive presence, and was a star, and often the only Jew on the field. So he became this lightning rod for attention, good and bad. Mm-hmm. And Jews looked to him and identified with him and kind of rose and fell with his successes and failures.
And he knew what he had to be to people of the Jewish faith and to confront bigotry. What a huge thing to have on the field, right? You can't not be aware of that, and to have to be a symbol of something better all the time.
Right. He became the standard bearer for Jews in his generation. And yet it was a growing awareness that he had of that role. He actually was a rather naive young man coming from the Bronx, which seems surprising today. But back then, the Bronx was a largely Jewish neighborhood, and so 95% of the Jews around or people around him were Jews. He never really had to confront his identity. But then he goes to Detroit, where in the 30s, Henry Ford is mm-hmm. the paterfamilias of the city. He's the been writing these screeds against Jews and is called the arch anti-Semite of America, and Hitler called him an inspiration. And then you have Father Charles Coughlin, who's a Roman Catholic priest in suburban Detroit with a radio show of 10 million listeners, eagerly listening to all of his rants against Jews, ruining American society. And so he goes into this hostile environment and begins, to, as he starts hearing from other Jews around the country with his decision on whether or not to play on the High Holy Days, he starts getting fan mail from, like one little girl wrote him a letter and said Max Baer, who was a Jewish boxer, had let her down when he lost. So please, she implored, Hank, don't let me down. And he started realizing just how important he was as a Jewish ball player to the rest of the Jews in America.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the fact that he was very, very large, 6 feet three, klutzy with flat feet, the description has been of him. So he had to work very hard to become a superstar baseball player. He didn't have a lot of natural athletic ability. Would it be fair to say that?
Well, he was blessed with speed. Sorry, not speed. He was blessed with size and strength and great hand-eye coordination, but not necessarily speed and agility. And as you mentioned, he had the flat feet. He was a little clumsy. He was 6'3 by the time he was 13 years old, so it took a while for his coordination to catch up with his size. But he was one of these Horatio Alger stories where he worked very, very hard. He would take hours and hours of batting and fielding practice in the park across the street from his home in the Bronx, and he continued that work ethic throughout his career, showing up at the ballpark an hour or 2 hours early, paying minor league pitchers or semi-pro pitchers to throw in batting practice. And as a result, you know, he put up these Hall of Fame numbers because of his hard work and honing his skills.
Yeah. And why don't you tell us some of those Hall of Fame numbers, how great a baseball player he was before we go into other aspects of his life?
Well, he played only nine complete seasons, and so his overall totals aren't as high as some other guys like Lou Gehrig or Babe Ruth who played much longer, but he does share records with them. For instance, when he retired, his 331 career home runs were fifth best all time. And along with Babe Ruth, he is one of only two players to collect at least 96 extra base hits in four different seasons. He also averaged almost an RBI a game. So he, along with Lou Gehrig and Sam Thompson, he shares the record for the most or highest RBI total per game, which is .92, or almost an RBI per game. In one season, in 1938, he nearly broke Babe Ruth's single-season record with 58 home runs in a season, and he batted in 183 runs in 1937, which fell just one shy of Lou Gehrig's single-season American League mark. And this is back in the days when they played only 154 games a season. So he was an extraordinarily good ball player. He led the league in home runs four times, led the league in RBIs four times, had a .313 lifetime batting average. So, and his all-time, he's sixth on the all-time list for power average, ahead of players like Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, Stan Musial, Mickey Mantle, and other names we readily recognize as great players.
And yet, until your book, of course, he remains relatively not unknown, but people hear the name and say, I think I know that person, but not a lot of attention paid to his career. Why is that?
You know, it's an odd thing, and I myself am a baseball fan, but didn't really know Greenberg's name until about 10 years ago when I heard a show on NPR talking about a documentary on Greenberg's life called The Life and Times of Henry Greenberg. Excellent documentary. And by the way, just a footnote, Aviva Kempner is putting out a new DVD of that documentary with 2 hours of extra footage.
Great.
So I'm eagerly awaiting that. But so I hadn't really heard about Greenberg, but when I heard that, I started becoming intrigued by him. And the more research I did, the more I realized this guy was one of the true greats, not just as a Hall of Famer, but I think he's one of the pioneering ball players who transcended the game itself but earned a place in American society. You know, you've got Babe Ruth, who legitimizes the baseball player as a hero for Americans. And then you've got a guy like Roberto Clemente, or Jackie Robinson, of course, opening the doors for African Americans and integrating baseball, being a civil rights champion. Roberto Clemente, who gives Latin Americans respect and a place in the America's pastime. And then there's Hank Greenberg, who transcended the game and transformed the way that Gentiles saw Jews, and in turn the way Jews viewed themselves. So It's like that this elite pantheon. Yet Greenberg, I think, often is forgotten or not given his due, perhaps because he didn't play in New York and didn't get the attention, but also I think because so much time has passed since his career, and he wasn't as flashy a personality as, say, Babe Ruth.
Some moments really say so much. I love the description of his collision at first base with Jackie Robinson, and Hank Greenberg apologizes to him for getting in his way. Probably Jackie Robinson didn't get too many apologies, did he?
I don't think so. Catchers were spitting on Robinson's shoes during his debut year. People were spiking him when he played in the field. Pitchers were throwing at him. And actually, the moment you referred to occurred at a very critical time in Robinson's debut. 1947, he becomes the first African-American to play Major League Baseball. He had just gone public in early May with the threats against his wife, the threats to kidnap his infant son, the death threats against himself. And then he goes to Philadelphia, and the Philadelphia players aim bats at him like rifles, pretending to shoot him. So he's very shaken. He's feeling quite vulnerable, discouraged, like he even wants to quit, give up on this experiment. The Brooklyn Dodgers, his team, go to Pittsburgh, where Greenberg is finishing his career with the Pirates. They have this collision, and the whole crowd kind of holds their breath, thinking, uh-oh, here we go. This is going to be the race riot we've feared was going to happen. Mm. And had it been any other white player, it might have taken place. But instead, Greenberg just went after the ball that he dropped. Robinson scuttled on to second base. Next inning, Greenberg reaches first base where Robinson's playing, and he says, "Hey, listen, I'm sorry. I should have asked, are you okay?" And Robinson said, "Yeah, fine. I just lost my balance." Greenberg said, "Listen, hang in there. You're doing fine. You're going to make it. You'll be okay." Well, afterward, Robinson said, "You know, class tells, and it sticks out all over Mr. Greenberg," because that support and encouragement from a white opponent really helped Jackie hang in there. And he did, as we know, do okay.
And a lot of people thought that about him. A lot of the writers thought about them. The guy had class.
About Greenberg?
Yes.
Yeah, certainly. He was a guy that was very charming and intelligent and loyal to his team. At the same time, he had a thin skin. And there were times when he got upset with the writers. He held out in 1936 for more money, one of the few players to do so at the time. And he felt the writers didn't support him the way they should have. Later, when he got drafted, he thought that some writers had been too aggressive in trying to pursue him, get his story, and also writing unfavorable things. So he had a bit of a thin skin and developed a bit of an antagonistic relationship with writers. But then certain writers, like Red Smith, perhaps the greatest writer of his day, complimented him, you know, quite highly. There's actually a writer, a guy named Mike Bauman for Major League Baseball. You ever hear that guy?
You know, I see him pretty often, except during the baseball season.
He quoted Red Smith saying, "One of the greatest players of our time, Greenberg, one of the most unselfish team men, one of the finest gentlemen." And I thought he summed that up nicely. By the way, please thank Mike for that nice article he wrote this morning.
Okay. You're on top of things, aren't you?
That's my job.
Let's welcome phone calls for our guests, and we'll do so in just one moment. Hank Greenberg is the hero of heroes. John Rosengren is our guest this hour, and he was referring, my husband writes for MLB.com in case that reference escaped you, and wrote about Hank Greenberg. I guess it's appearing today. I've been here, haven't checked there yet. So let's go to phone calls, all right? It's really a fascinating story. It's also fascinating because of the times and because of Detroit and because of what Hank Greenberg had to do, as our guest writes. He helped to secure for Jews their rightful place in America's promised land in the years before the nation of Israel galvanized ethnic identity. That's a big thing to do in a lifetime. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to go that route, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. John is an award-winning author. He has written a number of other books, including one on Hank Aaron, Hammering Hank, George Almighty and the Say Hey Kid, The Year That Changed Baseball Forever, Blades of Glory, The True Story of a Young Team, and Bred to Win, and he's written for a number of publications. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls with Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott. Oh, happy almost baseball season, sir.
Yeah, like, I care. Come on. Hey, when you're analyzing Mr. Greenberg's statistics, one thing that just has to be pointed out, he's also one of that generation that lost several prime years while serving in the military. So, you know, when you think of what his statistics would have been if you'd added in those, what is it, three or four seasons, I'm sure it would be even more of an impressive, what's already an impressive resume. But my question is, if he is growing up in the New York City area, and at that time they have the Giants, the Dodgers, and the Yankees all there, how does he wind up in Detroit? Wouldn't you think, with a fairly good-sized Jewish fan base, that one of those local teams would have been wise to have had him on the roster?
Yeah, excellent question. Growing up in the Bronx, you'd think it'd be a natural for him to wind up with the Yankees, and he almost did. But and also the Giants. His father, David Greenberg, was a bit of a Giants fan, not a huge baseball fan, but he had taken Hank to games. So Greenberg's dad actually sat in John McGraw's office for 2 days waiting to see if McGraw would give Greenberg a tryout, and McGraw finally said no. We've watched him play in high school, and we don't think he's any good. He'll never make it as a major league ball player. Well, the Yankees had a different opinion. They thought he could make it as a ball player, so they scouted him. And Paul Critchell, the guy who discovered Lou Gehrig, took Hank to a game, and Hank saw Lou Gehrig there with his massive shoulders and decided that guy probably wouldn't have a chance of budging that guy off first base. And Critchell tried to convince him, oh, yes, he's all washed up. Well, Greenberg thought differently and wisely signed with the Tigers, and sure enough, it was 9 years before Gehrig missed another day at first base. But just as a footnote to what you mentioned earlier, Greenberg did miss 47 months due to his military. He served 47 months in the military. That was longer than any other player except for Hugh Mulcahy during World War II. He missed three full seasons, parts of two others. So a Sabre member has projected that if Greenberg had played during that time, he would have probably hit about 502 home runs, been 11th on the RBI, all-time RBIs, and 50th in runs scored. But Bill James thinks that if Greenberg had hit him against replacement pitchers, he would have hit over 600 home runs. So you're right. If he'd played those years, his numbers would have been much higher.
One more quick follow-up, if I may. Do you think, as you say, you know, for those of us, even those of us who follow baseball, he's not a name that just like automatically comes to mind. But had he lived in the media center of New York, do you think it would be that way? I mean, I would. My suspicion is if he played on one of those major New York teams, everybody would know his name today. Don't you think?
I think so. If he'd been a Giant or a Yankee, even a Dodger, he'd be well known today. And certainly if he played today, we'd be hearing a lot more about him.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott, as always, for your call. Did he know what he was getting into going to Detroit with Henry Ford there and Father Coughlin?
No. As I mentioned, Greenberg was a bit naive as a young man. You know, he signed when he was just 19 years old, and he So he didn't really understand what he was getting into. He had never faced that sort of anti-Semitism before. He'd never really encountered it, like I said, because he's lived in a neighborhood where everybody was like him. So he never really had to question his identity and what it meant to be a Jew. But then when he reached that city of hostility, it suddenly made him confront who am I and what does it mean to be a Jew. And then as he saw all the Jews looking to him and placing their hopes on him, because as I mentioned, the time of intense, not just anti-Semitism, but ethnic identification, the newspaper writers always referred to these guys as like the Irish shortstop or the the German whatever. And Hank was the Jewish ball player, you know, the Hebrew hammer. And so he started to realize, wow, this carries a lot of weight, being a Jewish ball player.
Mm-hmm. You begin the book by his having to make a decision as to whether or not to play on Rosh Hashanah. Can you talk about how he worked through that?
Yeah, this was a difficult time for him. Here he is. He's this 23-year-old young man, and the High Holy Days come up. He's promised his parents he's not going to play on them. He'd been raised in an Orthodox household. He still went to synagogue himself and was observant. And then, but at the same time, he's playing professional baseball for the Tigers, and he feels an obligation not just to his teammates but to the city. This was 1934, so the Depression's hit the Motor City hard. Unemployment's about 40%. The soup lines, you know, are extending around the corners as factories close. And Detroit, baseball gives Detroit a diversion and something to feel good about. And they hadn't won a pennant in 25 years, and so the city has pennant fever. And they, of course, want Greenberg to play. So he's torn between his faith and his what he feels is civic duty and duty to his teammates is. So he ultimately decides to play on Rosh Hashanah. Oh, and this is so he plays on Rosh Hashanah, hits two home runs, wins the game for the Tigers, 2-1.
Yeah.
And then 7 days later on Yom Kippur, it becomes somewhat an easier decision because the pennant has already pretty much been secured with a 7-game lead over the Yankees, and so Greenberg sits. And in doing so, he sort of achieves this compromise of showing other Jews how you can assimilate by being part of the new country and its pastime, but also stay true to the old world traditions.
Thank you, Scott, so much for your call. Let's go to Susanna in Madison. Hi.
Good morning. I'm calling. I actually had one question first, and I switched it as you were speaking. And my comment or question is whether it might be a bit naive to think that he was so oblivious to racial discrimination, because it seems to me that as horrific as the anti-Semitic prejudice was, there was an equal, or maybe not as vicious, but equal sort of sentiment towards Gentiles and to read Yiddish and so forth. There was a very strong feeling of separation. And so while you said that Gentiles changed their views of Jewish people and Jewish people reconsidered their own identity, I'm wondering how, if at all, Jewish people changed their view of Gentiles, if it bridged some sort of union there too.
Well, I think as Greenberg got to know other Gentiles, and again, his friends had been Jews, and he'd known, you know, primarily associated with Jews when he was growing up. But as he got to know other Gentiles, I mean, he was a guy who, you know, realized it didn't matter what one's ethnic or religious background was, that, you know, they could be a friend or foe, regardless of that. And he certainly made many friends among the, he assimilated very well and easily among the Gentile community. And perhaps one of his best friends was a guy named Bill Veeck, who, after Greenberg retired, the two of them went into business and owned the Cleveland Indians and then later the Chicago White Sox. And Veeck, of course, not a Jewish guy, but the two of them were very, very close. And so I think Greenberg kind of became blind to someone else's religion, though never lost sight of what it meant for him to be Jewish.
Well, and you have to really concentrate on the anti-Semitic remarks that were thrown his way. We're looking at anti-Semitism here, certainly more than how Jews viewed Gentiles. That's a whole other story. He had some pretty nasty language thrown at him.
This came from opponents, of course, in days when bench jockeying was vicious, and they would look for any edge they could get on their opponent and seize upon it. And for Hank, it was his Jewishness. And even teammates would say things to Greenberg, and one teammate called him an ethnic name on the team bus, and Greenberg said, "When this bus stops, I'm going to beat the tar out of you." Sure enough, when they got to their destination, the two got off and had a fist fight. Another time, a pitcher on Greenberg's team challenged him and called him a Jewish bastard, and Greenberg fought that guy. So he wasn't afraid to stand up for himself. There was a time when the Chicago White Sox had yelled something at him on the field, and he, after the game, went into the clubhouse and he said, "I want to know who called me a Jewish bastard, and I'm gonna, and I want him to say it to my face." And he went around the locker room and looked at everybody, and of course, nobody stood up. And afterward, he left, and his teammate Bertie Tebbutt said, "You know, that guy was lucky, whoever said it, because he would have torn him to pieces." Mm-hmm. And that word got around the league and Ted, about that, and Ted Williams used to love to tell the story, and he'd say, "And you know who stood up? Nobody." So Greenberg was willing to stand up for himself, but more often he showed others up with his baseball bat, and he made his point with his performance on the field. And to the anti-Semitism, he said that it got to the point wherever he was hitting a home run, he felt like he was hitting one against Hitler.
That's a great thought. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Here's an email from Rich from Rhinelander. People forget how bad it was. People forget that hate was actually once respectable. Hatred was once very publicly and very unashamedly expressed. I recall some of my parents' customers commenting negatively on signs which could be seen at the entrances to country clubs and golf courses in the North Shore suburbs of Chicago. No dogs or Jews allowed. This was mid-20th century America, the 50s and the early 60s. There was, I recall, a lot of head-shaking and disapproval. I remember my parents and their customers agreeing that this just isn't right. This isn't even American. This isn't even right. And even within our own state in the early 20th century, one can sometimes hear anti-Semitic feelings expressed. It isn't over. We have to work at expressing our disapproval of hating people because they're not like us.
Right. I think that brings very true. And we do forget what it used to be like. And as I said, the anti-Semitism was as socially acceptable and widely practiced as Jim Crow laws in the South. And some people just didn't think about it or challenge it. That's just the way it was. You know, the
right.
Restricted communities, no Jews live here, or those signs that weren't just in around Chicago, but in Miami and elsewhere, no dogs, no Jews. And when you stop and think about that, it's like, wait a minute.
I know.
Wait a minute. What are we thinking here?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, for me, it was an educational experience to do the research for this book. I'm not Jewish. I didn't grow up Jewish. And so to learn what it was like for another person to experience that, not just one, but, you know, an entire generation of Jews, it really opened my eyes to the obstacles and barriers they faced, and gave me an appreciation for how significant it was when someone rose above them, and mm-hmm. then others could look to that person and find strength and inspiration in him. And mm-hmm. and I think you mentioned in your introduction too, this is before the State of Israel, so there was not that place where people could rally around. They looked for that sort of rallying point elsewhere, and they found it in people like Hank Greenberg.
Yes. Let's go to Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I've been wearing my baseball shirt for the last month, I think.
So. Time to wash it.
I haven't seen anything about Polish and Polish-American anti-Semitism. And I think people should know that in 1492, St. King Kazimir of Poland brought the refugee Spanish Jews into the country, into Poland, and gave them a special status. I mean, they were allowed to have their lawyers' licenses and doctor licenses and dentist licenses, I mean Spanish licenses, et cetera, and they were special advisors. And he gave them a lot of money to settle down into Poland after Queen Isabella kicked them out of Spain. And most of the anti-Semitism is more like a family spat, and it looks like anti-Semitism, but I'm not saying there isn't any, but the Poles were fighting the Roman Catholic Church to join the Irish hierarchy at that time also. I think that's all I want to say.
All right.
Well, thanks. You know, as I mentioned, there's been so much for me to learn in researching this book, and I continue to learn. I didn't realize that about Poland, that Poland had been such a friend to the Jews in the 15th century.
Thanks for the call, Kenneth. Lines are open if you'd like to join our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Josh Rosengren is author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. It's our conversation this hour. Let's go back to the war years here for a moment. You talked about how he was in the military longer than any other player. How did that happen? Why did he stay in so long? When did he enter? How did he serve?
Well, Greenberg got drafted in the spring of 1941, served 8 months here stateside, and of course this is before America was in the war. He was honorably discharged on December 5th, 1941, eager to resume his baseball career. At the time he'd gone in, he was the reigning American League MVP and the highest paid player in the game. He was the game's biggest star, and so it hurt him to miss that season in 1941, but he was excited to get back to baseball, resume his career, and of course 2 days after he was discharged, Pearl Harbor was attacked. So Greenberg became the first major leaguer to reenlist, went back in, and knew that it was going to be a long war, so he figured his decision to reenlist meant that his baseball career was over. At the time, he was 30 years old, but he was willing to make that sacrifice to serve his country. And that decision won him the respect of all Americans, and when he truly did become a hero of heroes. So he served, as I said, 47 months, almost a full 4 years, got out in mid-June 1945, and was returned to the Tigers. And the country was looking to him as a test case to see, could players return from the military and perform at the level they had previously? And they figured if Greenberg could do it after being out so long and not playing ball in the service like a lot of the other guys had, but if he could return, then maybe the other guys could too. And this was important not just to Detroit Tiger baseball fans who wanted to see their team do well, but it was important to all Americans because they're looking at a national pastime to return the nation to a sense of normalcy after the war when people had to make so many sacrifices, not just with rations, but losing loved ones. So baseball became this healing component for the nation. But it wouldn't work if the game, you know, stayed as lousy as it was during the war years with replacement players. They needed the stars back performing at the level they performed at. So Greenberg came back. His first game back, July 1st, 1945, he hits a home run. It's in Detroit, and the fans are go crazy. And it's just as though Odysseus has returned and Penelope rejoices. Well, then, to the end of the season, his team is in a pennant race. On the final day of the 1945 season, in the ninth inning, Greenberg hits a grand slam home run.
Woo-wee.
And wins the ball game and clinches the pennant. And that moment was one of those that, you know, all Detroit baseball fans will remember, who were around then at the time, will remember forever. And it became just such a highlight for them. And Greenberg went on then to lead the team to the World Series victory, and it was one of the most amazing comebacks in sport, you know, ever.
That's quite a story. Let's go to Helen in Sheboygan. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I love this show. I'm a big Detroit Tiger fan. Was, am, always will be. Listen to their games on the internet. And back in, I suppose it was 45 maybe, or 46, and the Detroit Tigers played an exhibition game in Battle Creek, Michigan, which is where I grew up. And so we all troop out to this American Legion ballpark for this exhibition game. And I have a friend who has older brothers, and her one brother had a used baseball. And he said to his sister, Marianne, will you take this ball and go up to Hank Greenberg and ask him for an autograph? And so she takes the ball, and she goes up to Hank Greenberg, and she says, would you sign my ball, Joe Louis?
Oh, and, no.
And he says, do you want me to sign Joe Louis? And she said, well, that's your name.
Oh.
And he said, no, really, it's not. My name's Hank Greenberg. And she said, well, okay. But we were probably 10, maybe. But I love that story. And then she gave me the ball because she's not a Detroit Tiger baseball fan, and I am. I still am, yes. Mm-hmm. Very good.
That's a great story.
But I love that story. I gave the ball to my son.
You gave them
also a Detroit Tiger fan. It's sort of genetic. Yes.
I'm sorry. Do you still have the baseball?
No, I gave it to my.
Oh, to your son. That I missed that part of the conversation.
Yeah, I gave it to my son because I thought, you know, when I die, well, whatever. Yeah. when I die, I don't want anybody else to get that ball except him because mm-hmm. he's still a big fan. So I gave him the ball. So there we go.
Nice.
But
all
anyway,
right.
That's very cool. And I still, as I say, and I saw that documentary that your guest spoke of. That's really very good. That was in the theaters at one time. I saw it in a theater in Houston, Hank Greenberg documentary.
It was.
Anyway, this is a great program, and it's very nice to know that there are baseball fans who now will be introduced probably to Hank Greenberg, and those of us that remember him will once again glory in his wonderfulness.
Oh, thank you, Helen. What a great call.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great story, and I'm glad your son got the baseball, the Joe Louis baseball. You know, actually, since you mentioned Louis, Louis was a Sandlot player, a pretty good player himself, ball player growing up. And so he was a baseball fan, and he and Greenberg became friends, and Joe Louis would make a point of going to the World Series games when Detroit was in it to watch Hank Greenberg because he said he'd rather be watching Hank Greenberg and the Tigers than training for his fights.
Ah, that even adds to that story. Do you have a team? Can I ask you who your team is?
Well, I grew up in Minneapolis, and my father would take me to baseball games at Metropolitan Stadium, and I grew up watching the Minnesota Twins and rooting for Harmon Killebrew, Tony Oliva, Rod Carew. Mm-hmm. So they're my team. I'm happy to see Torrey Hunter go to the Tigers this year because I think he's a great, great guy and he'll be a good addition to that team.
Yeah, word is this could be another good year for them.
Oh, I think the Tigers are the team to beat this year.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
All right. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about Hank Greenberg, hero, the hero of heroes, and we have to talk about where that phrase came from. Our guest is John Rosengren. He's the author of the biography of Hank Greenberg, and we are welcoming phone calls. Our number, one line is open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now for John, let's go to Robert in West Salem. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Over 60 years ago, I was a kid in high school in Atlanta, Georgia, and my mother worked as a nurse's aide in a hospital, and one time she had Hank Greenberg out as a guest to our house, and I had a chance to meet him.
Oh.
And the interesting thing I remember is that he survived the Bataan Death March. I saw a program of that, and it showed him in the lineup of all the survivors. So I thought that was very interesting.
Was he there? I didn't know he was there. John?
That's new to me. I haven't heard that. Wasn't that in the Philippines?
I can't remember. It was a Japanese death march, and he was a survivor. That's what I remember. I was just a kid then when I heard about it.
Yeah, that was in the Philippines. I'm not sure that story is accurate.
Yeah, I haven't come across that in my research. Because I know he was in China during the war, he'd gone over with the B-29s. That was the Americans' hope to be able to defeat Japan by being able to
the B-29s could fly longer missions, and so they could have a base a little farther out that was protected, and they could fly over Japan and bomb them. And Greenberg's job was to help scout and find that base. But this is, I haven't heard of him being that March.
Do you remember the dinner, Robert, when he came to the
house? No, I just remember meeting him and the name. I don't remember the other details. That was a long time ago.
Right, yeah. Well, it's good to have part of that memory. It can be resurrected in some ways. Thank you, Robert, for your call. Phil in Madison, hi.
Hey there, yeah. I went to college with his two grandsons. And they used to tell me some stories about their grandpa, but they said that the thing that he said was always the hardest thing to do after everything he'd done in life. He said the hardest thing to do was actually to hit a fastball. That's just the hardest thing you could ever do in this world.
I'll bet that's true. I don't know how anybody hits those fastballs. I just don't know how they do it. So how do they do it, John?
Well, I think you're right, and I think he'd probably say the hardest thing in the world to do is to hit a Bob Feller fastball, because Feller was his nemesis. And Feller, in his younger days, he was 19, 20 years old when Greenberg started facing him, and he was a bit wild, and one time threw, as a right-hander, Feller threw behind the left-handed batter's head, and so that's quite a wild pitch. Greenberg said he never felt quite comfortable batting against Bob Feller. He'd never quite dig in and feel secure because he's always had like 1 foot ready to bail out of the box. Anyway, the hitting a fastball is a curve, a really good curve, probably is the most difficult thing to do in any sport, and it just takes incredible hand-eye coordination, and Greenberg was blessed with that.
Tell me about his children.
He had three kids. From his first marriage with Carol Gimble, and that's Gimble of the Gimble Department Store Fortune. So when the two of them got married, you know, Greenberg was this American hero, and Carol Gimble was this department store heiress. It was quite a to-do for the celebrity pages, and Walter Winchell was tripping over himself with excitement, something to gossip about. So the two of them married in 46, and they had three kids, Glenn, Alva, and Steven, two boys and a girl. Glenn became a national, he played football at Yale. He became a state champion squash player, now runs an investment fund. Alva ran some newspapers in Connecticut and an art gallery. Her mother, Carol, was very interested in art, had studied in Paris as a painter, and got to meet people like Picasso. The third son, Stephen, has kind of been the keeper of his father's legacy and is the one perhaps most visible these days. He was at Yale a All-American soccer player and captain of the baseball team, played professional baseball for a while, got as far as the AAA level, but never was able to quite shake the Hank Greenberg son label, and wasn't able to make that final leap to the big leagues. But anyway, went on to be a deputy commissioner for Fay Vincent of Major League Baseball, and more recently has been called the king of the sports deal. He helped establish the ESPN Classic Channel and has secured naming rights for different stadiums and television deals for different major league teams. So he's on the scenes, or he's often behind the scenes, but he's a major player in the sports arena.
Phil, thanks for your call. Diane in Madison. Hi, Diane.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Interesting topic. My grandfather was an American League umpire in the late 20s, 30s, and early 40s. And growing up, we remember him. I don't remember details, but he worked with, of course, Garrick and Ruth and DiMaggio and Williams, Ty Cobb. And we just remember as kids always hearing the story that of all the players, Hank Greenberg was my grandfather's all-time favorite player. He was always a great gentleman when he had dealings with him on the field, right there at the plate. No matter what kinds of jeers and comments were sort of thrown at him from the field and the bench. But it was just my grandfather's great story of he being the great gentleman, at least on the field at that point. So it was kind of fun, little small addition to the conversation this morning.
What a fun job your grandfather had
and
as well, huh?
Well, and it was also interesting, he was a very conservative Irish Catholic from Chicago, So this speaks volumes about, I think, Greenberg's character, that he would have, you know, made this comment about him. So one other fun little sort of tidbit is I have inherited my grandfather's umpire's counter or clicker that he used throughout the years. And so I have this wonderful memento that balls and strikes and whatever. I can hold it in my hand and think about those times he, you know, counted balls and strikes against Babe Ruth or Hank, you know, Greenberg, et cetera. So anyway, it's kind of a wonderful legacy for our family for baseball. But,
it sure is.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks so much.
Great memento they have. Say, what was your grandfather's name?
It was Red Ormsby from Chicago.
Okay. I didn't come across that name in my research, but I know that Greenberg was a good friend of the umpires, and they often stayed in the hotel where he lived, and so he got to know them, and he was savvy enough to know that it behooved him to befriend them.
Yes. Well, obviously, it worked wonders, so just in general, so great.
Thanks, Diane.
Thank you. Uh-huh.
Yeah, what did Greenberg's parents think about his entering the profession of baseball?
Well, if you think about the times where here are all these immigrants who've come to the United States to give their children a better life, you know, to seek their own fortune and a better life for their children. And Hank Greenberg's parents, like most parents of their generation, believe that that route to a better life went through college. Well, Greenberg went to a semester of college at New York City College, but then left to go play baseball for the Tigers. And his parents were not too excited about this decision of his. His father accepted the fact that he could make some money doing that, but they really would have preferred that he went to college. He's the only one of their four children who didn't finish college. Greenberg was known around the neighborhood as Mrs. Greenberg's disgrace. She called the baseball a bum's game. But after Greenberg started having some success, David and Sarah Greenberg came around and became fans, and they even achieved a bit of a celebrity status in the neighborhood. Like, there go Hank Greenberg's parents. They kind of like that. So they went to all of his games. They when Greenberg's team came and played the Yankees, they'd go to the games in New York. They'd also go to the games in Philadelphia. They had a summer place in Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey, so it was about equidistant for them to go to either stadium. And they became fans and supporters of Hank. And, of course, after he, you know, had his great success and achieved, or became the highest-paid ball player in the game, I think Greenberg got the last laugh on his dad.
I'm sure he did. Let's go to Larry in Madison. Hi, Larry.
Hi. In the next generation, the Jewish hero was Sandy Koufax, and he made his fame in terms of Jewishness by refusing to pitch the opening game of the World Series against your Minnesota Twins in 1965, and they lost that opening game. But as the series went on, he wound up winning the final game 2-0 against the Twins, and it was kind of a fairy tale story of he refused to pitch on Yom Kippur, but everything came out okay in the end. But I think there was a difference. All those laws you talked about went down the tubes with the passing of the Civil Rights Act in 1964. And so he benefited, I think, from the change in religious and racial attitudes that had occurred over the one generation to the next. And I wondered, was there ever a relationship between Hank Greenberg and Sandy Koufax?
Okay, and we're almost out of time, John.
And you had to bring that up, that Koufax beat my Twins in 65.
Get over it.
Interestingly enough, you'd think that Greenberg and Koufax would have had more of a relationship, though I haven't found anything any record of them having anything more than one conversation, and that being brief. But you're right, too, that the times were different in 65 than they were in 34 when Greenberg grappled with his decision. And I think by 65, there's a bit more acceptance of one following one's own individual conscience and doing one's own thing, whereas in 34, there was much more pressure for an individual to toe the company line and for Greenberg to play for his team that day.
Thank you, Larry, so much for the call. John, it's been great fun. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Kathleen. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
John Rosengren, our guest this hour. The book is Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for producing this hour. Thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production in her studios in downtown Milwaukee.
Wenn mich mit zu der Ball geht, zu Eulen, wo mir doch geht. Kauf mir den listlichen Cracker Jack, will ich kein Mulf und dort nicht weg. Ich sag, mut, die Ballspieler, es passt nicht, als man verspielt. Weil sie sehen, sie weht, drei Steigs, neues bei der Welt.